All right, everybody. Welcome to the Good Time Show. I'm your host, Damon Epps. And today we have two incredible guests joining us who are making waves in the business and tech world. Michael Burton and Clayton Woodruff, the dynamic duo behind Lockstop. Haven't screwed that up yet, have I?
No.
Okay, great. Michael Burton, the CEO and founder of Lockstop, is a seasoned leader with 12 years of experience in the Marine Corps, along with his expertise in human intelligence and omni-channel business management at Walmart. Wow, what in the hell is that? His strategic vision drives Lockstop's growth. And then Clayton Woodruff, the CEO and founder of Lockstop, brings a wealth of experience in trail building, app development, and IT. His work in constructing cycling trails and app development ensures Lockstop product innovation and seamless operation. Oh, wait, operation. Let's try it. I got a speech impediment. Before we dive into the conversation, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, Blake Street House. It isn't just a social club. It's a community hub where diverse minds come together to foster inclusivity and innovation. Whether you're unwinding after a long day or connecting with your peers, Blake Street House is where creativity meets community. And The Ledger, the world's first bikeable building, offers a state-of-the-art workspace solutions, redefining the concept of work-life integration in downtown Bentonville. It's more than just a place of work. It's a hub for creativity, community, and innovation. And they're all under one hub, runway. So, let's give a shout out. Okay, and now let's dive into the conversation with Michael Burton and Clayton Woodruff. All right, guys. So let's talk about this Lockstop. What is it? What's it all about? How'd you come up with it?
Yeah, I guess we start from the beginning on how you come up with it. I feel like coming up with stuff is always that oh shit moment, right? And my oh shit moment for this was my family and I. We'd recently moved from San Diego to Bentonville. So when you're coming from California, you're carrying a lot of things with you, and you lock up everything there, your car, your dog, everything, right? And so we're riding into Bentonville Farmers Market. My responsibility is the maintenance of the bikes. My wife's responsibility, she'll listen to this. She got upset the last one. Her responsibility is the locks, right? And so bikes are rolling. Pedals are doing the things that they're supposed to do. We get into the farmer's market, and I'm like, Kel, throw me the locks. And you just see by the expression, like, well, there's her oh shit moment of mine both at the same time. So we didn't bring the locks. And like everyone in Bentonville, we spend too much money on our bikes. So I stood there while my wife walked around with my kids, gathering produce and all the fun things. And I'm standing there. I'm like, how do we have self-driving cars and I still have to carry a bike lock? And so that's really, where the idea started, and chewed on it for a little bit until got to grad school and then met this dude, and I'll let him kind of pick up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a ton of time in the cycling industry, and I mean, I've been riding my whole life all over the world, actually. So, and even for me, as much of a rider as I am, I literally never carry a bike lock. I've been in Colorado and Whistler and all over. And when him and I got together, started riding bikes, Mike, I always call him an idea fairy because he's just constantly pumping out ideas. One of the early ones was what we called the bike blanket, to kind of go over your bike truck bed, and which kind of exists in a way. But then he started talking about this, and when we got into the MBA program, specifically New Venture Development, which is their entrepreneurship hub, we were like, man, I think you got something here. And I was like, I have a lot of connections in the cycling industry. Like, let's explore this. And that's kind of what just blossomed from there.
Very cool. That's I will tell you though, I also don't carry a bike lock at all. And it's real dumb.
Yeah. We all know it every time we sit there in the restaurant, in the bar, in the cafe.
For sure.
We're like, oh, please.
And I'm just waiting for the, I mean, look, it is Bentonville, so I think it's like unlike any other place in the world where it is the last, I truly believe it's the last place on earth that I don't believe my bike's going to get stolen yet. I know those weeks are like, as the growth comes, there's going to be one little crappy kid that moves into this town and there's going to be a few more, or we're going to have that rush where there's a bunch of bike thefts in like 2 or 3 days where somebody comes in. Yeah. I shouldn't even be saying this. Now I'm putting it out there that there's available bikes for everyone to go. We'll cut that out. Maybe we'll cut that out so I don't lose my bike. Yeah, we have a solution. Or maybe we put it out there. Yeah. Maybe we cause a controversy. Maybe this is how we really stop the launch.
No one is locking their bikes.
No one is locking their bikes at all here in Bentonville. There is hundreds of thousands of bikes. No, I don't really lock my bikes here, but I also will tell you, I hate carrying bike locks around. Everything is so heavy and it's brutal.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it. So are these things out here yet? How does it work? How does this thing work?
Yeah, you know, so in the Marine Corps, I try to go all the way back there when I'm developing anything. We had, you know, this acronym called KISS, Keep It Simple, Stupid. And I try to take that through everything that I do. And so when we were developing, you know, Lockstop, we're thinking like, what are people already used to doing out there? Micromobility, ride shares, all those things, you know, we use our mobile device, we activate it, we use it. And so Clayton and I, when we were developing this, wanted to take that very similar approach. Like, how do we make a bike lock weigh as equal to your phone? So the big thing was making sure that the device that we have can update the existing infrastructure. You know, the time as a buyer at Walmart taught me a lot. Sam Walton taught me a lot, even though I never met the man. He's like, hey, get your costs as low as you possibly can and lower the barrier of entry for your customers. So making sure that we design this lock, then it can attach to anything and then wrap that in a patent. But then, you know, the user experience, it needs to be so intuitive. When I walk up, even if I've never used it, which no one has because it's a novel idea, I'll know what to do. And so simply scan the QR code on top, and that's it. The bike lock unlocks. It associates with your account. The next thing you have to do is just put it back, in, and then you're locked up. And so very simple, very simple.
It's very cool. And are these at Bentonville yet?
We are about to launch a beta test here in Bentonville. We're actually working with AWE, Art Wellness Enterprises. And we're going to do a pilot program, Crystal Bridges Momentary. And we're actually about to head out to Boulder, Colorado, to talk to them about a pilot program as well. So we're like right there, you know, of getting these devices out there, really getting it in production and having like the full run. So we're finishing up app development. We're, you know, getting all the little bugs out of this guy. So we're, you know, weeks out.
That's great. That's exciting. So I feel like I heard about this some like months ago. Not even months ago, years ago.
Yes, it's been 2 years.
Yeah, right at 2 years, man. I'm telling you, bringing anything from zero to one, holy shit, it's hard.
It's hard. Believe me, I've been here and I'm like, oh, I got this Planet Good Times idea. I'm just going to activate the community. I'm going to start this, getting this podcast off the ground. I've kind of taken a little bit of a break just to kind of get things back up and running. Man, it is not easy to do things, especially it's just the two of you guys right now, right?
We have a couple others. So we have an IoT guy that we brought on, software architect, IoT developer, AI developer. And we've recently brought on a CTO that's kind of leading, the future of our technology. So four of us strong right now. We're in the process of building the team. You know, as we get ready to pilot with a lot of these partners, we want to make sure, you know, we're ready to hit the ground running. I think we've, hit some traction that we didn't forecast a little earlier than we expected. And so now it's just building that foundation and making sure super strong.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. It's a good problem to have, for sure.
Yeah, that's a real good problem now.
We're scrambling this week to try and get everything ready for, like I said, this Boulder trip.
So the Boulder guys came out of nowhere, kind of?
They did, yeah. We got connected with the bike. It was actually a bike cop organization called IPIMBA. It's the International Police Mountain Bike Association. I personally hadn't even heard of it.
Oh, yeah, because everybody was just here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, wow, if I screwed up. There was the largest amount of cops on bikes I've ever seen in my life. I came out and I was like, all right.
Don't do anything
Thank
wrong.
Thank God I'm old now.
Exactly. So we got connected with them and showed them this, and there's one guy in particular who's like the bike theft guru, and he was a bike cop in Boulder for 30 years, still is. And he was just blown away. And that was June, I think. And we're literally like, get you guys out here. Let's do this. And it's kind of a funny full circle for me because I actually went to CU Boulder and I spent 10 years out there. And so I moved back here in 2015 and I actually spent 15 years in Colorado in general. So it was just kind of hilarious because we've always talked about, hey, let's just launch this here. Let's grow it kind of organically nearby to manage it. Then all of a sudden Boulder's like, hey, we want to bring you out here and check this out. I'm like, tell my wife, like, man, I have to move back to Boulder. So
you said you rode a lot of bikes. Were you a pro biker? Were you did the whole thing? Or are you just in it?
Well, no, definitely. I raced a lot younger. I mean, I rode since I was little, but got like very into it in high school. I was mostly just really into kind of what they would call the free ride movement, which was like this big mountain, you know, Red Bull Rampage type stuff. And then Whistler going up to the bike park up there. And then, of course.
Is that like downhill?
Downhill, yeah.
So I was like super.
I did that.
Super into downhill.
I wrecked.
Yeah, I've done that.
I hit my chest so hard. I've never. Yeah.
Was that the one and only time you did it, and you did not do it after?
It was like we went up to. It was in California, and so we just all went camping, and I don't know where we were. I don't know if it was maybe Big Bear. I think it was Big Bear. Yeah, we went to Big Bear.
Yeah, so you did some big stuff.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, yes. I mean, it was, we were up there and we were cruising. I was having a good time. And then I just slid on some sand and I just hit the ground with my chest so hard.
Hey, man, it's all part of the experience.
And you have best friends there because the first thing they did was start laughing.
Oh, yeah. Actually. Yeah.
Are you okay? Don't trust the guy.
They didn't even ask that. He just started laughing. Yeah. And then he asked if I was okay. Yeah, I was like, well, I don't think I'm dying, but it's fine. It's fine.
So anyways, I spent a lot of time in Whistler riding downhill up there. And then in Colorado, of course, being there for 15 years. So, but in terms of like profession, it was just the cycling world being trail building. I mean, I was just building a lot of big shit and, riding as much as I
could. Oh, got it. So that's where you started trail building?
Yes.
Now, your brother is the owner of Progressive Trails,
yes.
Correct?
He's the owner of that. Started in 2006 here, and I moved back here for a little bit. Built, here, Slaughter Pen, early days. I think that was like phase two. And then I moved back to Colorado, and then about 2 years later, I rejoined him, and actually I was running the whole West Coast operations. So a lot of Colorado work.
Oh, very cool. Okay, got it. So you went from – so you came back – And what'd your brother get into? Was your brother already doing that? Was he?
No, I mean, it was like he just basically fell into it. He actually has a master's in education. And he was like in this process of finishing his master's, trying to get a job in education. And at the time, I mean, he was, riding, of course, and racing. And they had a downhill series locally. It was like Devil's Den, Eureka Springs. And he was the only person that really did that kind of riding. And when the Walton boys, Tom specifically, was trying to, build the trail building community here, he was kind of looking for other sort of people that knew how to build different types of trail aside from just your basic single track. And his name kind of came into the fold. And so he got just sort of asked to do it. I mean, didn't even know that it was a thing, right? Like, who heard of trail building as a profession?
Did he construct nothing?
No, I mean, he had a background in like landscaping a lot. He had done a bunch of landscaping. And it was a lot of fly by the seat of your pants, kind of figure it out as you go. I mean, there are some books out there. I mean, not to get too technical on the trail building parts, but it's mostly about water mitigation. It's significantly changed now, but so he just kind of figured it out. And then I came back and same thing, figured it out for a little bit. And like I said, I left for a couple of years and then he sort of built this whole company at that point. So it was just
crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just had Gary Vernon on, as you know.
Yeah,
and so, nice. Before we watch this, everybody will be educated on the Gary Vernon side of things. Nice. And then I'll do the – yeah. And so, all right. So then you started buying nicer and nicer bikes. And
well, I'd always bought the nice bikes.
Oh, you did. So you were already that guy.
Yeah,
so
yeah. No, I was,
have you ever had a bike stolen?
I actually have mostly had bike gear stolen, oddly enough. I've not personally had as much.
That's
bike
a compliment,
stolen.
Isn't it? One's stealing your bike. They're stealing the clothes you're wearing.
Yeah,
it's like, dang.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was your bike not even locked up? They stole, or they just stole the gear
I had somebody steal. Literally, it was like moto and bike gear. I mean, I made it really easy for them because it was in a nice, awesome bag, like moto bag, and they actually came into my carport and stole it. It was sitting in my carport. This was in Fayetteville.
Rude.
Yeah. Right. Bunch of a-holes.
Yeah, I saw.
He's got the best. He's got the best bike story that he's told several times.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's hear this bike story. Let's hear it.
It's not as good as Clayton teased it up to be. I started off Maysville, Kentucky. Grew up in this small, two bedroom apartment in an apartment complex called Beechwood. Government subsidized housing. For anyone that doesn't know, it means the projects, right? And so you're not getting a lot of new stuff going up. So I was definitely not that guy getting the brand new bike. I mean, I think I got my first bike when I was 6 years old. And man, this thing was freaking sweet, right? 24-inch, candy apple red, like sweet-ass little chrome pegs on there. And I rode that thing around all day till the streetlights came on. And then, mom's calling, come in. And so I go lock it up to the water meter, behind our apartment, because that's what you lock things to there, and lock it up. Next morning, super pumped to go ride my bike, run out there. There's no bike to ride. And, you know, so the bike got lifted in the middle of the night. And in the neighborhood where I grew up, it was like, okay, I'm not going to go look, you know. They obviously needed it more than I did. And so it's really funny to come full circle, you know, 30 plus years later and be the founder of a public bike lock network. So that was my one and only bike that I had stolen. You know, I wasn't like Clayton. I didn't grow up riding a lot. I'm usually a reflection of, you know, my community. So I lived in Hawaii, California a long time. So
what part of Hawaii?
I was in Kaneohe Bay, so on Oahu. So I spent a lot of time, you know, there.
So that military stuff?
Yeah, that was okay. Military stuff. So I just happened to be fortunate, you know, with that that assignment that I was only a half a mile away from a private beach that just had this wicked 4 to 6 foot, you know, 4 to 6 foot swell that I could just go surf 3 times a day. So I spent a lot of my time, you know.
This is the kind of military I'm talking
about.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
You should hear some of the stories. Yeah. It's the best. Yeah. Some of them I'm just like, man, that's intense. Others I'm like, what? You got paid to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. So, all right. So Hawaii, and then you said where?
Yeah, so Hawaii, California. I say I spent a lot of my time.
So you surfed in California, yes. Then you went where?
Yeah, so Hawaii, I think, was before then. I've been in California a few times, I think.
Okay.
They just love me over there. They just keep forcing
keep coming
me
you back,
direction.
And then you try to leave, and then they get you back.
I don't think I ever really tried to leave. They just kept saying, hey, you have to leave, and then they'd put me in Hawaii or then back in California. But a lot of the time, you know, I was training or deployed, so, you know, all the fun places that everyone likes to visit on vacation, Iraq, yeah. Afghanistan.
Yeah, I do.
All those fun places.
They have beaches. Yeah, they got to get water shipped there a little bit, but there's a lot of sand. There is a lot of sand to go with it, but, well, that's – okay, so then you did your military stuff, and then you moved it. Did you just start biking when you got to Bentonville?
I bought a bike, I think, the last maybe 2 months when we lived in San Diego. I bought a bike. I'm like, cool, I'm going to be a biker. And I went out. I'm like, man, this is boring as all get out. It was just this flat little trail. I'm like, I'm not going to be a biker. And so
– was it a mountain bike?
Yeah, it was a mountain bike. I don't know if it would qualify as a mountain bike compared to Bentonville standards.
Right. But, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing. You know, this thing was probably $400. And at that point, I remember my wife and I having a conversation. And she's like, are you going to spend $400 on a bicycle?
I know, it's crazy.
Right? Now, and it's like, are you going to spend and we know what the last 3 years.
Dude, it wasn't even expensive. I spent $2,300 on it.
Was
it steel?
Yeah.
Steel.
My brother owns a bike shop, and I'm like, I got it. I mean, I got the bro discount, you know? Like, that was only $6,000.
Which one does your brother own?
Now? Yeah. The Hub.
Oh, he owns the Hub.
He owns the Hub, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know he owned the Hub.
He does, yeah. I know.
I buy your bike. I basically buy your bike.
Yeah.
Every bar tab.
Yeah, I bet. Hey, you can name drop me maybe.
See. I love that. Yeah, they don't
tell me no Woody. More.
I'll tell them I know Woody.
Put it on Woody.
They're like, hey, can I get... You know what I don't do? I don't ever get the discount that I'm supposed to get over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, right.
I always forget.
Funny side story, I actually don't either. Every time I don't even have like my name in there, I'll like go in there and I'm like, ah, I mean, I'm Woody's brother, you know. They're like, oh yeah, we'll give you the discount.
I always forget that I get one because of like Blake Street or whatever.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I think you get a Blake Street discount over there. Yeah. It's a great bar.
It is. Yeah.
It's one of my favorite bars for sure. Right. Good margaritas. Okay, so what in the military did, I guess this is that all the mechanisms and all the kind of technology that, because what's your background in the military?
Yeah, no, I'm a non-technical founder through and through. So I was a counterintelligence, human intelligence specialist. So effectively just got paid pretty well and traveled around and had conversations with people.
What does that mean in the military?
Yeah.
He was a spy.
Yeah, I was about to say, what does that mean?
No, it's realistically kind of what you do is you're going into a place like we typically vacation to and you know, you find one of those individuals that are from the local economy that may have access to information that's appealing to you or some of your stakeholders, and you go befriend that individual, you know, understand who they are, they understand who you are, and start trying to understand, you know, what is it that drives you, what's important to you, and then, you know, making sure that you're bringing that to the relationship, and then all of a sudden you say, hey, P.S., I'm U.S. Intelligence, and we've had a relationship for quite a while. Let's make this official and then, you know, kind of reporting up those conversations, the ones that should be. And so, yeah, I mean, it was very fortunate. I got to experience a lot of different cultures, speak with a lot of different people from, you know, dirt farmers up to high levels of the government. And so, you know, human intelligence really is that. It's just out having conversations with people, making friends, and understand what makes them tick.
Maybe I could do that in the military.
You probably could, yeah.
I'd be really good at that.
until everybody started shooting at each other. And that's then I'd it. Be like, can we just not? Can we just
that guy over there?
Yeah, that guy. You know what I mean? I don't like hunting. I definitely don't like. Yeah, I don't want to do it. Yeah, that sounds scary.
No. Yeah, that's what I said. Someone's like, Mike, have you been in a gunfight? I'm like, if I get in the gunfight, then stuff has gone really awry, right? You know, so I'm the guy who talks to people. I'm the guy who talks to people before the gunfight happens. And so if I'm in the gunfight, then, you know, shit went really south, you know? And so that was a good aspect for me. I got to, you know, kind of travel around and then, you know, not have to get shot at all the time.
That's good.
Yeah, that is good, yeah. That's eventually, good. I think they hit most of the time. So the fewer times you can get shot at, the less likely you are to get shot, right? So...
I mean, the beauty of his experience, though, just with us, is that he spent his life in security. And so,
okay, that's what I was trying to get at. Of like, how is this?
Yes.
How is this military background gone for the safety of your bikes?
Yeah, that's a good thing. You know, so part of my role is doing threat vulnerability assessments. And so I'd travel around the world, military installations or folks that are traveling abroad, and I would do these very comprehensive assessments of military installations, government buildings, or, you know, targeted buildings, and kind of understand, hey, where are our gaps in security? So playing red cell, like if I'm the thief, that's similar to how we approach this. You know, we approach this with the mind of a bike thief. If I'm a bike thief, how am I stealing your bike? And then based on those gaps we identify in an installation or in a bike lock, we go out and find either, you know, the physical deterrence or kind of the technology that will strengthen that to continue to make the target hard. And that's what we've done here is we've really looked to think through all the ways a bike thief is going to steal a bike. And then we filled those gaps with either, you know, physical materials or some kind of technology.
The thing is one hefty looking bike lock.
It's heavy.
25
pounds. Yeah, it's heavy.
So our constant joke is that we developed the lightest bike lock in the world because you don't have to carry it.
That's it.
Hey, that's right. I know. I read that. I was like, I go, really, man? I don't know why they.
Yeah.
I was like, doesn't this thing attach? I'm like, not even. I'm like, yeah, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. I'm just like, oh, it's the lightest one in the world, and it fits on the.
Yeah.
I was like, why did they make it so light?
How did they do that?
It's like, oh, okay, now I get it.
We've had that question. Like, I would never carry that. I'm like, I hope not, because that means you've taken it from the place it's supposed to be.
Yeah, now you've stolen the. Now you've stolen the lock stop.
And this does have GPS, and we know where you are. Yeah. You know, so don't try to.
We can get far. I mean, honestly, that was the big value prop for us, right? Is like, you know, again, being in the bike world forever, nobody carries locks, period, for the most part, and then
because all idea is to be light.
Yeah, especially in mountain biking. I mean, now commuters, obviously you are, but even then, big heavy chain like this, I mean, it's 10 pounds. So we're like, okay.
It used to not matter. Now, like, if I'm carrying water bottles and stuff, I'm like.
I mean, again, like, being in that, it's like it was all, the Camelback was just amazing, and everybody wore it. I wore it constantly, and then it got to the fanny pack. That was a whole thing, and I broke down, finally got one, and then now it's gotten to the point where everything is fully integrated. You know, everything's integrated with the tools and the water bottles, which was like, in the 90s, that's what we used to do, you know, is use water bottles. So now when you talk about locks, it's just like, of course, I'm not going to carry that. And so it's adding that level, you know, for one, the convenience, of course, but just adding that level of security where if you were to carry a lock, you're probably not carrying this. You know, you're not carrying a chain that weighs 10 pounds. It's going to take, you know, a while to get through. And then, of course, we can just add all the technology because it's there since we're not moving it around. So we can have, like you said, visual deterrence. Audio deterrent, so we have like a notification system. You know, if somebody was to try and clip it or grind it, it would literally send your phone a notification. You know, we're still exploring the like skunk spray or like a dye pack.
Yeah, dye pack.
For real?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's a joke, but it's also true because there is a company out there that does individual bike locks, and they literally have one that has. I don't think it's a dye pack, but it's like a skunk spray in it.
I'm telling you. Yeah.
We're like,
that is really funny.
Wouldn't that be amazing? You thought bike security was boring, and you got folks out
there. Yeah, people. Like, it's also just hysterical. Like, yeah, okay. Like, yeah. It's like, okay, he stole your bike. He may get it, may not get it, but now you've just really pissed him off.
Exactly. I think about the people that are around that person. You're like, oh, great. I did nothing wrong here.
Yeah. He might have given up, but then after you sprayed him with skunk spray, that dude is determined to destroy that thing. Exactly. I mean, I would. If I got sprayed by a skunk, I'd be like, oh, this lock stop is going down.
Yeah.
I am going to murder this lock stop.
Exactly.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Wow. So how did you get, I know you guys came up, how you came up with it, but have you guys always been entrepreneurs or what was the dream?
It's been a mix. I mean, for me, it's been a mixed bag. I mean, obviously I've worked in sort of a startup world. My job after I graduated and kind of worked here on the trails a little bit was I worked for a video game development company.
Okay.
And so it was, I mean, I say startup, it was a $90 million game, but it was still very much a startup environment where I was part of this operations team. Again, I knew nothing about operations or tech. I mean, I was like pre-med, you know, I obviously didn't go that route. And so I've always kind of been around.
Oh, that. You were going to be a doctor.
I was.
Got a handsome doctor.
Yeah, good-looking guy.
He is a good-looking man. You know what I mean? You would have been.
Down and everything.
You know? You know? I guess you just you found love. There's no reason to find a doctor. You're like, why work so hard? Why work so hard? Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you're good. So, anyways, you know, so I've kind of been around that in that sense. And then, of course, with PTD, I mean, it was, you know, my brother had been doing it for I think 2 years before I joined
PTD.
Progressive Trail Design.
Okay, there we go. I know, but
acronyms,
I just
he's all about acronyms.
I know. It's like the whole acronym scene, man.
Yeah.
PDD.
Yeah.
PTD.
PDD.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, he can go into the Walmart world. It's just as bad there, I think, as the military, the acronyms. But anyway, so I, you know, was with that. And obviously, I helped grow that for over 8 years. And I was running my own thing in Colorado. So it's like, yes, I've always kind of been in and around it. But this is the first kind of true thing that I've started with Mike here, where we've like both of us are starting this again from zero to one. So.
Yeah, and me, we had lifestyle businesses. I owned a photo film company when I was in California, so did a lot of event photography and had a videography team. And then, you know, we've owned rentals in California here. But a scalable venture, completely, you know, different game. My background's so nonlinear. I spent 12 years in the Marine Corps, and then I had to figure out really quickly what I wanted to be when I grew up. So went and did a Master of Education, become a school teacher. Realized really quickly, no, this isn't my calling.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah,
you know?
It's tough.
Similar
yeah.
to my brother.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. It just never occurred to me. Well, I mean, I looked at my grades, and that probably would do. Like, I probably shouldn't be a teacher. You know, that's probably.
I probably should have looked at my grades before I went and did a Master of Education. Yeah, well, I shouldn't be a teacher. But yeah, I've done that.
What grade did you want to teach?
Eighth grade. Yeah.
Why eighth grade? You know what? That sounds like the worst possible grade.
I think it was because it was the easiest test. Like, hey, eighth
grade. Oh, they test you on specific grades?
Oh, yeah. You have to test for specific grades. And you feel like an idiot, right? You go in, and if you test, you're like, oh, wow.
Wait, eighth is the easiest?
It was. You
not
know,
first?
Not first. Right. Oh, no, I couldn't do first. I have three littles at home, and I love each and every one of them, but I'm definitely not first grade teacher material.
Okay, got it. Okay, I was like, what?
You
you have to learn to chew on erasers correctly.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, eat your crayons appropriately.
Yeah, it's okay. All right. I was scared there. I was like, I felt like I could do that. Yeah. I wouldn't want to, but anyway, sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah, I did tattoos for a long time too. I thought, you know, I really did enjoy tattoos. I love art. So I did a lot of that when I was in Hawaii.
So you're somewhat of an artist as well, huh?
Yeah, I do. I love to paint, draw, write, you know, all the fun things.
So you're pretty and he's fancy.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yeah, we're a good duo there. Yeah. And then, you know, like everyone that comes to Bentonville, you find your way to Walmart. So I spent a couple years over there as a buyer managing the automotive chemicals and refrigerant category. And then spent a little bit of time over at Sam's Club as a senior product manager. But, you know, really pulling out the value from kind of each one of those roles. And what we've found is this very nonlinear background has helped us solve problems, you know, completely different than what most people do. It gives us, you know, experiences to select from, you know, that not a lot of folks that have this very linear background, you know, have. And so I think originally I used to look at it as, oh, gosh, I'm never getting hired. And then I would get hired and I'm like, oh, I can't do this. And, you know, I would leave and I'm saying, I'm never getting hired, because each time they'd say, oh, you have quite a few, you know, historical roles here. And, you know, for me, I looked at those as like, dude, each one of those roles, I learned so much about something. And now with having our own.
What does the word historical roles mean? Was that a compliment or an insult?
You know, you could take it either way. Yeah, like old jobs, effectively. Like, what are the past employments? You know, anytime you're going into an interview, right, they're looking over your resume.
Like, when they find a way to, like, fancy up. Yeah, like, exactly. Well, this thing's all over the place.
Yeah, that was it. It's like, yeah,
that's a nice way of saying it's a shit show.
Yeah, I think, whoa. Yeah. So you don't know who you are. Yeah. Okay.
I would have probably just said that to myself. Like, this is bad, you know? And then, you know, once we launched this scalable venture, you start to realize that, man, that's the real value of having this very nonlinear background, experiences with different people, different cultures, different, you know, responsibilities. And so, it continues to, you know, add value to what we're trying to do.
I mean, just on this journey, it's like going zero to one, especially with just two of us, is you have to be able to figure out everything. Like, we're doing budgeting, we're doing financial projections, we're trying to design a product, We're trying to design like an app. I mean, I literally design the UI UX for our beta app that we're going to launch, and I'm not a UI UX developer. So I just like was like, oh, Figma, let's figure this out. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not great, you know, don't get me wrong, but you know, it's something that will get us to where we need to go to that next step, which then it can obviously, you know, get funding and then really launch like a legit app, that kind of thing. But it's just that, again, like Mike said, that nonlinear background, because both of us kind of have that, where it's allowed us to just be like, okay, well, if I can't figure it out, then, you know, like, yeah, you have to.
I always wonder with my background, like, what job I could get at Walmart. Like, what is, I mean, I know I've been producing.
They do podcasts.
I can do podcasts. But I always just think about, like, because a little bit like you guys, like, I have nothing about producing television is linear. Like, every show is, like, I did the first tattoo show in the world.
Okay.
So I did the first tattoo show in history. So, yeah. It's called Inked.
I watched every episode.
So, yeah. So, Carrie, it was a very good show. It was, like, the first tattoo show ever. So, I don't have any tattoos. But I can tell you that I have more education on tattoos than most any person that has tattoos. I did three seasons of tattoos and the dating shows. And so there's... But it's just problem solving.
Are you an expert on dating then?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no doubt. Well, yes, I am. Yeah. We had this conversation the other day, and I was arguing with these groups of girls of just like, this guy went on a date, and he had dated this girl for like a week and a half, 2 weeks on a trip, and he very much was like, well, I'm going to call her tonight, and I'm gonna let her know. I mean, what are you going to let her know? He was like, well, you know, and I go, it's been 2 weeks, dude.
She doesn't care.
I go, she did. You went on a trip. He goes, well, you know, I don't want her to get upset. I go, it seems like you have a huge ego and that you're doing this for you.
Yeah.
It's 2 weeks. She lives in New York City.
You're so amazing.
Like, you're so amazing that you have to do. He was like, well, no, I just think it's the nice thing to do. And I go, dude, the minute you do that, she's going to go back to her girlfriend. It's like, I don't even know what this guy was telling her about. He was like, well, we said some super intimate things. I go, oh, you said intimate things when you were intimate. I go, weird. Oh, that's so weird, dude. You didn't just like go, oh, wow, that was really great. I was like, I don't know if you're hungry. Like, you say all the things.
Yeah.
But it was just, oh, we went on, and I was just telling him to do the fadeaway. But there was these girls that were like, no, I would want to know. And I go, do the fade out like everybody else. Like, just don't, you know, you called every day, you like call once every 3 days, and then just be friends. Like, it's totally fine. Like, when it works out, it works out. You don't have to, like, tell them. They know.
Yeah.
And like, and then she was like, no. And I go, look, I get it if we are both in Bentonville, because if with the break, you know, then
you're going to see each other.
You're going to see each other at Lady Slipper every Friday and Saturday night for the next like few weeks and be like, hey, you know, like just whatever. When I see you, I'll high five and, you know, we do it other things, but we're going to see each other every day. Yeah. That's a different thing. But when you're in New York City and you're in Bentonville, I was like, you got a small town head and you're talking about a girl has 10 million guys like at her disposal. She's going to be.
It's actually funny. I just had this conversation with my 19-year-old like 2 days ago. So he did the fade out with the girl.
He did.
And my wife was on the other side.
Of course.
Tell
her. And they all, and by the way, the girls all say, they all say this, but then they say this. And then right after they do it, they'll tell all their girlfriends. They're like, I don't know what he thought he was. He wasn't all that. I wasn't even into it. Like, it's just, you can't win.
No.
You can't win. But I do love, I'm about to do 5 weeks of a show. And it's going to be crazy. It's going to be, you know, be so wrapped up. It's three celebrity men looking for love. Which would be there? I mean.
Well, maybe we can get a little pitch in there, you know, put them on a bite.
Oh, yeah, dude. You know, let's see what,
let us know. Get it in Atlanta.
Yeah. You know, and maybe there's a crazy girl on there that wants to steal his bike, so she'll pay attention to him.
Oh, we've already got it.
Sounds like a great
producer.
Yeah, great storyline.
I'd watch that.
Yeah, it's a good storyline. You know, like, see if I can get him on bikes, see if I can get the insurance for it.
Yeah.
But it is funny. Like, I'm going down this path and starting a company called Planet Good Times. It really just feeds the community. It's more of like a promotion company that kind of starts parties, kind of do what I do in reality TV. And then I have a media company called Label, and we're doing marketing, and we're going to start working with like Walmart and hopefully and all those guys. But my background just kind of is problem solving. Like, it's like none of this stuff makes any sense in how we're going to do it or how we're, you know, figuring out how to get to the next chapter, but you just, after pulling from all the nightmares of the problems that come on,
Well, hey, if you're looking to join our team, we'll pay you nothing.
Dude, I'm in. Just vision. Dude, I'm doing that right now.
Mike always tells us. Yeah,
what is he what is doing that right now?
What's the? I am doing that right now. I'm really killing it. What has been the hardest thing that you've had to overcome with this big piece of device that keeps blinking at me?
Physical product?
Just all of it, whatever it was.
Well, I'll speak to physical product. I mean, physical product is just how do you basically make this thing smart, shove a bunch of stuff in there, and then also obviously try to make it where you cannot overcome it. Because we've physically beat it up, put it in a refrigerator, you know, hit it with a mallet, like taking a grinder to it, doing all those things. And as soon as you solve one problem, you like start messing with it, and then another problem pops up. I mean, as a small little example, even just this little metal piece right here that wasn't there before, this one that's welded on. And because I took a mallet to this, and it eventually broke the locking mechanism. So the chain just fell out. And I was like, well, crap. If you have like a mallet, you can just hit it real hard a few times, and then your bike's gone. So I was like, okay, how do we solve it? And then you put this there. Well, now you solve that problem. But it's that constant, like, once you solve one, and you're not going to solve everything, but you try to get it. For us, we're just trying to lower that barrier as much as possible, especially compared to what's out there. And that's where we talk about the whole alarm piece and the, hopefully skunk spray at one point.
Oh, spray it once. Because if you actually do break it off, or if there's any kind of rattling.
Break off. Yeah, we put this thing through the freaking ringer. I mean, with every device that you can think of. You are not breaking that unless you're an angry person that just got sprayed with skunk spray.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing is freaking tough, and that's the way it was designed. So the fact that you don't have to carry it, you know, we're able to add a lot of components in there that you wouldn't carry on your own. So, but the hardest thing is just all the things you don't know. You know, when I was a buyer at Walmart, you feel really effective in your role. Like, I'm managing this big business. I'm making a lot of money. I'm dealing with 25, 30 suppliers, 200 SKUs. I got this, right? And then you come out to your venture, and you're like, all right, great. I need to go to a sales call. Let me get the sales collateral. And you're like, oh, yeah, I have to create the sales collateral. You know, so you literally have nothing. You're starting with a zero. And so every conversation that you have, every email that you send is from nothing. And so there are a lot of unknown unknowns, you know, when you're starting a venture. And there are still, like, I think that's what keeps us up most at night is just like, what are those unknown unknowns that are going to tank us? And then, you know, Clayton and I being very diligent about going out and trying to figure out, you know, as much as we can. Maybe we're not subject matter experts in every space, you know, mm-hmm. like grant writing or logistics, transportation, university. But we know enough to find the people that know way more than we do. And so that's been like our big initiative is like, how do we find the people that know all the things that we don't?
Yeah, and building a team is tough. I mean, that's been our
I'm doing that
challenge.
Right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's been the biggest challenge because our mindset, you know, again, we've been doing this for 2 years, so it's like we're basically brothers at this point. I think I talked to him more than I talked to my wife at this point.
Sorry.
exactly, to both of them. And so it's just we are just kind of one mind in that sense, and so we're trying to bring somebody else into our vision. And so obviously it's hard to find somebody that's going to have that same level of passion and drive as we do to try and get this done. I mean, I'm sure you've experienced that.
Yes.
A lot.
It's also something Gary V. Yes. I don't quote Gary V a lot, but that was the one thing I remember him saying in a social media ad somewhere that he was like, don't ever hire someone and expect them to care about your product as much as you do.
Sure.
He was like, cause that's just not realistic. He was like, that guy didn't create the device and he's not going to get the 400 million if it does blow up.
Yeah.
Like you're going to get all that. And that's the whole point.
When it's tough too, cause like your pool of people that you're drawing from, you know, a lot of my exposure has been, you know, really high level corporate. And so you think that you can kind of draw on those personalities. But if you've been in corporate for a really long time, you're used to that HR department and people say things to you a very specific way, you know, a positive sentiment like, hey, I really appreciated how you did this. But maybe we do better this next time, you know, and it's very positive reinforcement. In a startup, you don't have time for that.
No, it's
right. Like yes. We are critically candid. Like Clayton and I will hate each other for, you know, 5 to 10 to an hour a day, and then we regroup. That's because neither one of us, you know, like wrap our words in flowers. We say what needs to get done, if it wasn't done appropriately, and then, you know, how to solve the problem. And so when you're building your team, it's like really important that you're finding those people that have similar values and are okay getting their feelings hurt. Because if you don't get your feelings hurt, you're not making progress towards anyone or anything. And then we work a freaking lot, you know? So people are like, oh, yeah, I would love to be there 9 to 5 p.m. It's like, yeah, that's the middle of the day. But we're also, you know, up from 4:30, 5 a.m. and we're still generating and pumping out stuff at 11 p.m. You know, Clayton sits on the line 3 days a week, 4 days a week at 10 p.m. with our dev team in India. You know, you put someone that doesn't have our values in that role and they see that as an inconvenience where we see it as an opportunity. And so that, like, building the team, glad you called that one out. Yeah. That one's tough.
Yeah, it's especially here. I mean, people don't work past 4 o'clock.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. But we do. We, work. I mean, there are two of us here.
there's two.
And me.
We have been fortunate. You know, we've had some struggles here and there, but we've definitely been fortunate with the team that we've gotten now, where we have been able to find, you know, an IoT guy he's used to that. And these guys are, the other two people are, they have full-time jobs. So, you know, we're on this full-time. Well, they have full-time jobs and are trying to also help us and support us. And that's, and of course we did that for the first 2 years. I mean, both of us just went on full-time, me a month ago, you what, 2-3 months now? Yeah. So it's been an ebb and flow, but I think the key is probably just knowing how to fight with each other.
That's true.
It is. It's funny. I have a, I'm learning because, you know, we're starting a marketing firm and I feel like that the world of marketing is changing and it's kind of going into our world of like an unscripted kind of like, you know, content building instead of just like the networks are all dying. So that's all going away. The way kind of like the way you've learned how to speak. I was trained in such a development world of working, you know, the networks would give us some money for a development or whatever, or somebody was coming in for. Well, just the other day, somebody came in and was pitching themselves and like, hey, I've got a really great idea, which usually starts with like, it's me. and you're like, you're really not that interesting. Yeah. And that's really the truth. And so when we hung up the phone, we all did that. You know, there was a group of people like, well, you know, they did this great thing and they did that. And I go, dude, it is a solid no. It is an absolute not even close to interesting. There's nothing about this that's interesting. I know that they were in the military. I understand that they have these interests, but there's no Saving Private Ryan. There's no, like, there's a lot of people in the military, but not everybody had three, you know what I mean? There's not three brothers or whatever,
right?
That huge story that makes it compelling.
Yeah.
But I don't know how I wasn't trained to do the flower of the words because it was just like, we don't have time. Creating a show and doing the development on a show is so hard.
Right.
That you just learn, and I'm learning that I have to do all the flowery words right now because now we're in marketing and it's like we can, and it's not necessarily true. I don't have that no anymore because we were just joking the other day. Like my head is like, well, that's not what is on network television. That's not what people are going to buy. Well, now people are watching by the millions, people organizing the refrigerator. I just
my wife watches that a lot.
That's what I mean. So it's like I have to totally re-engineer what I think. I was like, that's a terrible idea for a show. But it's like if we can create content that just goes viral, then that's just worth money. It's just like no matter if it's scripted or high-end scripted or unscripted.
If you can explain that to me, I would love to understand.
It's just mind-numbing. You know that Chive TV stuff. You know, you're over at the first seat. It's crazy. All right, so we dive into that. But yeah, I do think that like building a team is really tough, and I've been very fortunate or unfortunate. The TV world is kind of crashing, and then so I have all these incredibly talented people that are all looking for the next thing because we're all kind of hungry. And so I was able to like call like 5 or 6 friends after we came up with this idea, and it has come together very fast. And we have the most incredible team ever now. All right, so you guys are big fans of Bentonville, right?
Yeah, yes. I do.
Yep. What do you love about this town the most?
I mean,
I know what I love.
Again, I grew up in this area, and Bentonville was nothing. I'm sure you've heard the story plenty of times, but you know, it was nothing.
Oh, I wouldn't have been here.
Yeah, I mean, 20 years ago, like, growing up in the 90s, 80s, 90s here, I mean, it was like a ghost town up here. And then the trails built around it, and then you know, hopefully nobody from Boulder listens to this, but like I came from Boulder, which is like a very much proclaimed bike town, and I got here, and I was like, man, Boulder has got literally nothing on Bentonville. Because the interconnectivity of the trails, it's really like a testament to what, trails and just outdoor community can do to an area. Like you see it, like it builds just the people come here, people just generally seem happier. You know, just the other day when it happened to be nice out in August, which is fantastic, like I noticed, I even made this comment to my wife, like we were walking around 8th Street Market and I was like, the people were like, hey, how's it going? What's going on? You
know, it's the nicest, like, it's the weirdest place.
Yeah. And then you get that.
I love it so much.
Exactly. And then now my complaint when I came from Colorado was, you know, food. Because it's like, we miss food. And then music was a big one because I'm a huge music lover, and everybody always came through Colorado. So you had Red Rocks and you had all the small venues in Denver and Boulder. And then I came here, and then all of a sudden, you know, we move up to Bentonville from Fayetteville in, I think, 2020. And they announced the Format Festival, and it's like down the street from my house. And so anyways, it's just, I think that they've just done such a good job of kind of bringing in, you know, obviously the food and then the trails and then the music and just the whole scene with the arts. And it's just, you know, it's a great, great spot to be. And it's obviously perfect for us launching what we're launching.
And you have kids and the whole thing.
Yeah,
and
we both have kids and, you know, all that fun stuff. So
now I want kids just because I live in Bentonville. Right. You know, it's like.
You can babysit anytime.
Anytime.
Three. An age. Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, I got five. So yeah.
You have five?
Yeah, that's a lot of kids.
4 to 23, so.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. The three older ones are my stepsons, but they're all my wife's kids, so. She claims all of them.
Damn. That's a lot of them.
It's a fun journey.
Sister had five. It's
He's
a lot
got
of
four.
You got
yeah.
four.
Yeah, yeah. Three off. Littles at home, four in total. Yeah, so never a dull moment. But I think about Bentonville, like you really boil it down, like you actually get to exist here. You know, when you're in California, everyone's looking at their shoes or their phone.
Yeah.
And when they're walking, they're like looking down, or they see you approaching them and they intentionally look the opposite direction. And you're like, gosh, like what is wrong with people? You know, in Bentonville, like you just said, people look at you like, oh, I'm actually here. And then they say something to you like, oh, hey, good morning. You know, and I'll say like my 6-year-old son, you know, is growing up here, and we've been here for the last 5 years since he's one. And this kid says hello to everyone.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love it.
Oh yeah. No,
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And so I think that's my favorite thing. People actually look at you.
Yeah. I tell the story quite a bit. I feel like people are actually listening to the show. Like the guys that listen to it, I always go through these like things of how much I love Bentonville. And I may have said this a gazillion times, because I lived at the base of the Hollywood Hills. So I walked to Hollywood Hills every single day. I just walked to Hollywood Hills. And I'm also a Texan. So people actually speak to you in Texas. Nothing like here, though. This is like the nicest people I've ever met in my good. And it's people that come from other places that come here and they start being nice, which I also find interesting. But I would walk to Hollywood Hills and I would go and I would have my little dog. We were walking up and I would do two things. I would see how many people would say hello to me in the morning. With like looking at me, because I'd said hello every morning. I would always go, hey, good morning. And then people would just walk past and they would not even look at you. Yeah. And you would think it would just be like, maybe it's like a younger girl or a young coop, which you totally get. But it's like grown ass men. You're like, you can't say hello. And then the one that would really always get me, and this happened all the time, people would come up. You would go, hey, good morning. They wouldn't say a word to you. They would bend down, pet your dog. Oh, my God, you're so cute, whatever. And then they would get up and then they would walk away. And I was like, that's not your species.
Yeah.
I'm your species. Yeah. So whatever. But yeah, Bentonville has been the biggest shocker for me. I moved here just because of a girl. And then, you know, that's moved on. And then now.
Did she fade away? I have to ask. I'm so sorry.
No, it was not a fade. I still love her dearly. You know what I mean? So she's still, you know, she's still around. Yeah. But yes, no, there was no fade away. There was no fade away. No, I moved here for all the right reasons. But now, I love this. You can't get me to leave. I'm just like the spot. I have serious thoughts of like one day I want to be mayor. Like why not?
Nice.
Like I want to be all in on this place. You know, I really just think it's the coolest place and the nicest place.
The opportunities here are kind of wild.
They're wild
for us because there's been so many kind of VC conferences and all that, and we've literally talked to entrepreneurs coming in from New York, and you know, him and I are connected with venture capitalists, and we've had deep conversations with a lot of them, and these people from New York are like, man, how did you even get a meeting? Like we cannot even get a meeting, and we're just like, oh well, I mean. Yeah, we're just connected with them, and you know, some of them are even mentors of ours, and it's just like these opportunities, like it's easy to take for granted.
Yes,
especially as a startup, as like what we've had available to us, and you know, because it's not like that at a lot of places. You know, we had that MidCon VC, which was here, and they had 300 VCs from all over the world, I mean, there was some big names.
Yeah, I was here, and I was like, yeah. I was listening to. I just went upstairs. I didn't even.
Yeah, exactly. You just walked upstairs.
I just walked upstairs, and I met a friend, and I was like, oh, I'll sit down. Yeah. Next thing I know, it was one of the founders of PayPal.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah. And I was like, wait, he did what?
Yeah.
I was like, so he knows Elon Musk? No, he doesn't. Yeah. And I was like, oh no, Oh, okay. Oh, this guy's rich.
Yeah.
This guy's a different kind of rich.
You know, he's not where we live. Come on now.
Yeah.
He's small potatoes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good point though, is because you never know who you're surrounded by here in Bentonville.
Yeah. No, yeah.
You're out riding a bike with some grimy ass dude and you're like, oh, that person's worth $500 million, $500 million, or, you know. Yeah.
I tell my friends all this. And by the way, this whole marketing company that we started with, shout out to Aaron. My buddy Aaron was VP of Leonardo DiCaprio's company. Okay. And so I went home and I was like, dude, you should just see like the CMO of Walmart, William Wyatt. Like, he's doing all this really cool stuff. He's making scripted content into whatever. And then I was like, and you wouldn't believe. I go, dude, Walmart fashion is on the up. And from that moment, he just looked up and he goes, excuse me, what'd you say? And I was like, dude, Walmart fashion's on the up. And I was passionate. I'm like passionately telling him the truth. And he was like, well, I mean, like, and it was like, it just spurred a level of jokes that have never stopped. But I'm still serious about it. I'm like, no, you don't understand. It's getting on the up. Yeah. Like, one day I'm going to be wearing it. It's not yet, but one day I'll probably be wearing some Walmart stuff.
You get real defensive about Walmart. I think that's some part of the indoctrination process that you're unaware of.
I was like,
Walmart. I'm like, what do you say about
what'd
Walmart?
What'd you say?
Like, yeah.
What'd you say?
You got a problem with this?
You got some with aisle 35? You got a problem with aisle 35?
Like, what? You go to Target? Like,
come on, dog. What is
that? Yeah, exactly. You don't even realize you do.
Yeah, come on. No, yeah, it's funny. I am very. I don't have no connection to Walmart whatsoever, but sorry, Walmart, but back in the day, my mom would be like, we're going to Walmart. Like, you don't got to go to Walmart no more.
Yeah.
It's like, stop going to Walmart. You're going to get killed. Yeah. You're going to get killed going to Walmart. I just did never go. And I was like, mom was like, you can buy shorts for $2. And I was like, no, now I'm all in.
Because you're risking your life. Well,
yeah,
mom.
So, yeah, like, you're risking, thing, yeah, you're right, risking right, your yeah. life, which is, yeah. you know, not
I risk low
have,
cost.
To be fair, we have really fancy Walmarts here.
Yeah.
We get all the best shit.
Oh yeah. No, this Walmart here is a whole different thing.
I have to ask, so where did you grow up in Texas?
So I grew up in Dallas, Lake Islands, North Dallas.
Both my parents went to TCU, so a lot of connection to
– Yeah, I went to North Texas and then University of North Texas and then decided I wanted to be a comic or an actor and flew there and then that was brutal. And then, and then found a way into music television and then found my way to reality and then Jersey Shore and then all the Jersey Shore nonsense and then, Flavor of Love also, you know. Did a lot of iconic, you know. You saw my resume of trash. Some of the biggest –
It's pretty solid.
Yeah, one of the biggest, best resumes of high-end trash you can possibly have. But I'm proud of it. You know, some people get really upset, and I'm like, I don't know, man. It's good storytelling. I don't know what you want, but I was in charge of a lot of the characters, so.
I don't know how many seasons Jersey Shore had.
They're still going. My buddies, going? Yeah, my best, my friends own, my one of my best friends, Sally Ann Sosano, owns the company, and then my best friend, Sean Hogan, is still the EP on the show, so they're still doing it. And actually, Pauly D is coming to Fayetteville, and a little dream. Pauly, if you're watching this, I know you're not, but if you were, I'm gonna try to get. If I could get Jersey Shore at Blake Street,
Blake Street Shore. I like it.
If I could get the kids at Blake Street House, would be unbelievable. Do you want to show me how this thing works, or is it kind of there?
Yeah. No.
I think it's yours, right?
Let's see here. All right. Yeah. So super simple. Open up the LockStop app on your phone and then you just scan to unlock. So you have, very similar to all of your other micro mobility solutions. So I'll go back so we don't miss any of the three
all right,
steps.
There we go.
So as I do, right now it's locked. So imagine you're coming back from the bar, the cafe, church, wherever you're at, and you just want to unlock it. So scan to unlock there, gives you a little cue and then hold it above the area, and then that's it.
Wow, that's dope.
That's super simple, right? Yeah, keep it simple,
And then you just put it back?
Yeah, and then...
No, so it doesn't allow you to lock it if you're not connected for obvious reasons, so people can't just come up and lock it.
Yeah.
So
because I would have been that kid that went up and locked every, kind of thing, and so...
It'll just, like, sit there, and then we'll put a hook on there as well at some point, but the reality is that most people are just going to drop it.
So.
Right, of course. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's metal. It's fine.
Yeah, so, it's going to be okay, right?
So
yeah,
it'll just sit there. But yeah, like I said, that was intentional to be like, hey, we can't just have it, you know, be able to just, boop, you know, all of a sudden just random people logging random stuff. So.
Yeah, and, you know, we try to, again, make it very simple. Like, when you go up and you're getting ready to lock your bike, you know, you're getting your visual feedback here on the front end, and then, you know, you're also getting very similar feedback in the application, just to make it ridiculously simple. I gave my six-year-old my phone, and, you know, my six-year-old can't read, so don't judge. You know, he's in school for that, right? and I said, hey, Kroz, go unlock the lock stop. And, you know, one, he doesn't know how to function a phone. I'm one of those odd parents. They don't spend a lot of time on devices. And so I opened the app for him, and, you know, he's clicking the buttons, and, you know, he comes up, and he did have an issue, though. I'm going to be real honest. He was too short to hold his phone above the device. And so after I lifted him up, my six-year-old son, who can't read, locked his own bike to the lock stop. And, man, that dude was so excited. You know, just by locking his bike.
That's very cool.
And so the reason it's blinking at you so much is that it actually has a motion sensor. This thing's battery powered.
Okay.
And so we put a motion sensor in it just so we're not draining the battery all the time.
Yeah.
And so it will turn off and go into like a sleep mode, that kind of thing.
Here, I'll lock it, Clayton.
Yeah,
so you can
go for it.
And again, very similar, right? So you're coming up to the bike lock. Is you have your mobile application open. Everything's ready. In your application, it's going to check the status. I'm like, okay, is this lock, you know, good? Mm-hmm. We put in some fail safes there so, you know, you don't lock up to a lock that's going to die. We come out and replace battery. So again, so all you do is scan the device or open your QR code there. I raise it above the thing, gives you a little yellow indicator, said you better hurry up. And that's it. That's simple. And then when the lock is locked, you go to the screen in your application and it tells you, hey, here's how much time you've been locked up. And so you can kind of see here, it says lock is secured, tells you the time you've been locked up and then the cost associated with that. So try to make it ridiculously easy.
That's really awesome, man.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. Well, I love what you guys have done. I think that, like I said, like interviewing all the people that are really doing cool things here in Bentonville is what this show's all about. And I think that you guys have something cool. I can't wait to like lock my bike up and because I really do just drive around like and I bought nice bikes. Yeah. I actually buy really nice like cruisers. And if it got stolen, it would really change my life. Yeah, well, I bought one. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I am a guy that buys nice stuff, and you only need, you know, I believe that you just buy some few nice things and then mix it with some Walmart fashion.
We'll definitely get it out in front of Blake Street, you know, for our own selfish reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. Well, is there anything else, guys?
Man, I think we covered the bases. Unless you want to do a deep dive on, you know, Jersey Shore or something.
Well, if you want to talk about Jersey, we can talk about the inner. I don't know if it's acceptable because there's a lot of things. Well, guys, this was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Appreciate you for coming on the Good Time Show. And yeah, let's go riding.
Yeah, man. Sure, we appreciate you having us.
I bet. Sweet. Well, that's our show. If you didn't get a chance to watch the episode, check it out on YouTube and Spotify. You can also listen to The Good Time Show on Apple Podcasts or any other platform. We are always trying to grow our Planet Good Times community, so subscribe and follow us at Good Times Us on almost all social media platforms. This episode was presented and recorded live at Blake Street House Sound Lounge in Bentonville, Arkansas, a social club where people from all walks of life come together just to be themselves and make the community a better place. Till next time, good times, everybody.